Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a summary of the week's news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. On the show this Friday morning, we're talking about the tax overhaul that Utah Senator Orrin Hatch helped champion, also the shrinking Great Salt Lake, air quality, and a little bit later in the program, we'll have a holiday movie preview. Joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod is with us. Emma, good morning. Thanks for
being here. Good
morning. Editorial page editor George Pyle, welcome back to you and good morning.
Good morning.
And on the phone, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Hello, Tommy, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And listeners, you can join us with your questions and your comments about the stories that we are covering today. You can post them at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also put them on the KCPW Facebook page. Thomas Burr, in Washington, Congress has passed a massive tax bill. It contains some big tax cuts for corporations created as permanent tax breaks. It has temporary tax cuts for individuals. There is a lot in this legislation, a lot that we've been hearing about all week, actually. Tommy, goes without saying that the entire Utah delegation voted for this because this was largely, if not entirely, a partisan vote, correct?
Yeah, of course. This was not a shocking at all. Six Republicans in Congress from Utah voted for this. And this really was a Republican measure. Democrats really didn't have any part of it, a little part, I guess, of it. But it was a very, very partisan vote, strictly down the line in the Senate. In the House, some Republicans voted against it, but very few. And it actually, the president just signed it a few minutes ago, so it is now law. And it will be interesting to see how this all plays out, because as we all realize, it's December 22nd. These things will go into effect immediately, so the IRS and all the other people are going to have to figure out how to make this work pretty quickly before you start filing your taxes.
Wow. You know, among the biggest champions of this tax overhaul was Senator Orrin Hatch, and like most of the legislation's GOP proponents, he says that this will lead to economic growth. And the idea is essentially that companies will spend the money that they get from tax savings, that they'll hire more people, for example. Am I putting the right words there?
Yeah, we've heard this one before, the trickle-down economics idea. The Republicans, Orrin Hatch, say, you know, if you're going to give the corporations a tax break, then they're going to, you know, give that to their employees. I mean, we saw actually AT&T announced that it's going to give its employees like a $1,000 bonus. You know, other companies are saying they're going to raise, you know, minimum wage up to a higher place for what they're paying their employees. We'll see how it actually works. Obviously, the stock market, you know, likes it, and corporations are pretty excited. A huge cut for 35% to 21% on the maximum rate. Individual taxpayers will see a benefit yet next year. They're not sure how much, depending on how much you make. But the, you know, obviously the wealthy are the biggest winners here, in a percentage wise of how much they're going to see back from their taxes.
What's the cost of this bill? The overall price tag?
It's about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. Some studies have shown essentially that it's going to be cost about $1 trillion to the deficit, because they believe that actually, you know, that will boost the economy by about $500 billion. And again, this is over 10 years. And again, the people who are supporting this bill say, you know, at the end of the day, it's really going to be a benefit for the economy, so it really won't cost, you know, the too much to the deficit. Democrats are saying, you know, that's not how we've seen it before. If you remember the Bush tax cuts in the early 2000s, didn't really improve the economy all that much.
I don't know where to throw this question, but it's is there a lot of evidence for the idea that it's going to have there been, for example, a Congressional Budget Office score, or has any tax organization taken a look at this and said, yes, it will massively boost the economy, or no, it's not going to?
There have been various studies, and depends on what perspective, I guess, you want to look from. So far, you know, it should have some benefit for sure. There's kind of no question about that. But then, you know, what does you know, say Roger McDonough gets $700 or pays $700 less in taxes next year? How much are you really going to see that in your paycheck? And will you notice it that much that you'll go out and, you know, spend more money in the economy?
And again, the individual tax cuts will expire in 2025. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So the corporation one is permanent, but the individual one, does expire, all the Republicans say, oh, don't worry, we'll renew it when we come down to it. And they essentially had to do that because if they let it go permanent, it would have cost too much, and essentially they wouldn't be able to do it with just the 51 votes in the Senate. They would have had to have 60.
Okay. George Pyle, Tribune editorial page editor and editorial writer. Donald Trump, the president, has referred to this as a gift to the middle class. Senator Hatch, too, has framed it as being for middle class families. It seems like the analysis doesn't necessarily back that up, given the fact that, as Tommy is saying, this is weighted toward the wealthiest people in the country.
Well, clearly it is. I mean, clearly the big part of this is the corporate tax cut. And a lot of people are for corporate tax cuts. Barack Obama proposed a corporate tax cut. Part of the idea was that nobody's really paying the top rate anyway. We say it's, 35%? And it's now down to 21. Obama's proposed putting it down to 28. Previously, most of those proposals have also had some other thing in it that made up some or all of the revenue that would be lost, but the idea was that the corporate tax rate was too high, especially compared to other similar countries, countries in the EU, Canada, places like that that we're competing against. And so kind of as we looked at it in our editorial this morning, this was the silver lining that we found in this cloud, was that a corporate tax, a cut in the corporate tax rate, which Republicans and Democrats have been proposing for a long time and nobody ever got it done, is part of this. And among those who think this will stimulate the economy, this is the main thing they're hanging their hat on. And we'll see if it does stimulate the economy. If we have significant growth in the GDP, then it would be fair, the way these things work, for people to say, look, here, I told you, we cut the corporate tax rate. We cut the tax rate for rich individuals, which isn't as important really as to most people as the corporate tax cut was. And if it does stimulate the economy, create jobs, build incomes, then, you know, that'll be great. Most economists don't think that's going to happen, at least not to the degree that Orrin Hatch and Paul Ryan say it's going to happen. But this is now to the point where what we said was this is now, you know, Donald Trump's tax bill. This is now Donald Trump's economy. And if it goes up, he'll get the credit. If it goes down, he'll get the blame. And this is, you know, presidents get too much credit for what happens and presidents get too much blame for what happens because they're the focus. Everybody knows who the president is. But he, now they're saying people who are for this bill and people who are against this bill are saying, okay, the economy, it's now Donald Trump. He owns it. And good or bad, it's on him.
Well, any, you would, I guess, just any incidental growth or growth that might occur, I mean, as though growth in and of itself is of benefit, but that any growth that might occur would be a cause and effect sort of thing. That, you know, the tax cut happened, tax package happened, and so growth happens. Can we draw a direct line between those things?
Well, somebody will try, and you know, it's like I've got my lucky rabbit's foot. I fell down and broke my leg. Well, if you didn't have your lucky rabbit's foot, you would have fell down and died. Mm-hmm. So anybody will look at this and say, you know, if the economy does okay or good, the Republicans will say, you know, it's because of us. We did this. And if the economy does poorly or really badly, then the Democrats will say, see, I told you this is a bad idea. It didn't work. It didn't trickle down. It didn't increase wages. It didn't increase employment. You just bought back stock and bought another condo with it. And so it didn't help the economy. And cause and effect is really difficult, especially in macroeconomics.
Sure.
That doesn't stop anybody from claiming it.
I want to just push back for one quick second on the corporate tax cut being the boom, because it seems, analysis shows that corporate tax cuts are going to benefit rich people a lot more than middle or lower class people, in that they are maybe the owners of companies, the owners of corporations.
Well, it depends, you know, as Tommy was saying, it depends on what the rich people do with that extra money. Several of them did roll out yesterday and say, we're going to give bonuses or we're going to raise pay, and not just for the C-suite, we're going to do it for everybody. You know, to some degree, this is a PR move to say, look, because everybody was saying, you know, everybody who was against this bill was saying, no, they're not. They're not going to raise wages. They're not going to hire more people. They're not going to ramp up production, because they never do they ramp up production when demand goes up. They don't ramp up production because they've got money lying around. They ramp up production because demand goes up. And, you know, the amount of money Apple's sitting on right now, Nobody wants to buy any more phones. We all got phones. And so they're sitting on billions of dollars in Ireland or something. And now they're going to be sitting on more billions of dollars in Ireland. And whether that's going to do anybody but Tim Cook any good is kind of doubtful. But, you know, but there are companies that are going out there today saying, we mean it. We're going to raise pay, and here we are.
A quick reminder to listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. Call us at 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. Thomas Burr, going back to you, you wrote that, you wrote about Senator Orrin Hatch having some very complimentary or laudatory words for President Trump because of this legislative action. Well, almost fawning words for the president. Tell us about this.
Yeah, he lathered it on, that's for sure. So they did a little, South Lawn victory lap, the president, all the members of Congress, the Republicans at least. And Hatch was just incredibly effusive. He's called Trump one heck of a leader. He said that he believes, that he's already said that he thinks Trump's one of the best presidents he's ever served under. Then he also mentioned this exact quote, and we are going to make this the greatest presidency we've ever seen, not only in generations, but maybe ever.
Yeah. Greatest president ever. This is an ongoing sort of burgeoning relationship between the senator and the president, right, Thomas?
Sure, they talk frequently, from what I understand. The senator obviously endorsed Jeb Bush and then Marco Rubio, but then he stood by Trump when during the election, and has just been very kind and said really nice things about him all the time and defended him.
Right. Yeah, and helped invite him out here for the national park.
Yeah. Exactly.
Redesignation.
I mean, that's a big deal to be able to get the president, in the middle of all this stuff going on, to fly to Utah and do the gutting of the bear's ears and Grand Staircase. It was a pretty big coup for Hatch.
Okay. Hey, another thing that this tax bill does, which seems to have less to do with taxes, is that it strips away the individual mandate from the Affordable Care Act, which is expected to decrease the number of people who are insured by some number of millions of people. Like, I don't have the number exactly.
It's 13 million.
13 million people. That's something that I know Democrats are unhappy with, and the idea is that that's going to affect a lot of people.
Yeah, sure. That's obviously a very unpopular thing with Democrats and healthcare people, that the individual mandate forced people to get on the rolls. And now when they're not on the rolls, healthcare could go up for other people. Other people may not be able to afford it, and they'll just drop it. It's essentially getting rid of one of the key parts of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that made it work.
George Pyle, that part, that provision of this tax plan, stripping away the a provision that I think was advocated for by insurance companies originally because they wanted to make certain people were...
This is how we co-opted the insurance companies not to kill Obamacare in the first place.
Right.
Here's the deal. You have to insure everybody. You can't turn people away because they're already sick or they got diabetes or, they got acne, or you can't turn them away for that. The other half of that deal is everybody has to buy it. And if they can't afford it, we'll help them. We'll have subsidies, or we'll put people on Medicaid that the government pays for. So everybody's in the pool. Everybody pays into the pool. That way health insurance companies can afford to insure everybody. That's the way insurance works. It's always been the least popular part of the Affordable Care Act because it makes people do something that they might not otherwise want to do, sometimes oblivious of the fact that that's the only way it will work. Mm-hmm. And they were unable to repeal and replace. I mean, the people who voted for the tax bill are all celebrating that. A few months ago, they came this close to repeal and replace Obamacare. They couldn't quite make it. So now they're celebrating this, and they put a piece of that into this bill. And it works in terms of the parliamentarians because it's a tax issue. It's the mandate is a tax. You have to pay a tax penalty
if you don't
have health insurance.
Right.
A couple of arguments. I mean, and the president said the other day, I asked everybody not to talk about this until it was passed, but this is how we're going to kill Obamacare.
Right.
And I'm glad nobody talked about it. People did talk about it, but I guess nobody said it to him, or they didn't say it on Fox and Friends, so he didn't hear about it.
It's crippling. It's crippling Obamacare.
It could. I mean, there has been some research. I mean, the enrollments are way up now. I mean, the penalty is still in place. Enrollments are way up, despite the fact that there's been no advertising. The enrollment period was cut way back. They've done all kinds of little things to try and kill Obamacare without getting their fingerprints on it. And I have read a few things that people are saying, you know, maybe the individual mandate isn't quite as important as we thought because people are actually buying health insurance. They're figuring out that they need it.
Right.
And they're figuring out that especially where there are subsidies and the subsidies are still in place, they can afford to buy it. So maybe it's not quite as crucial as we once thought. The other argument is that there are a lot of gaps and cracks and things in Obamacare anyway that they need to go back and fix. And so this now becomes one of them to find another way to do this, and they need to go back into it anyway. So this is just an opportunity to do that.
Tommy, in D.C., Democrats are up in arms about this point, one of many points they're not happy with about the tax bill. And they also point to polling that shows that this bill is unpopular, and they say that they're going to use this in midterm elections, right?
Sure. That's definitely going to be on the calendar on everyone's mind next year in 2018. Democrats are going to point out, and they're hoping, I'm sure they're not hoping the economy tanks, but they're hoping people realize that this really didn't benefit them that much, and it was all just kind of a show. Republicans are saying, you know, this will really help them in 2018 because people will see more money in their paychecks. At the end of the day, again, it depends on if you really notice how much you're getting back. If the economy improves, if you see your tax return increases, or the amount of taxes taken out of your check aren't as much, and you have a little more cash, you're a happier person. You're more likely to vote for the incumbent party. Democrats, you know, don't see this as actually being big enough to persuade people to vote Republican. And at the end of the day, they'll say that this didn't work and it was a scam, and vote Democrat.
Well, it's interesting that we'll leave this topic behind. I'm sorry we're spending a lot of time on taxes, but that the benefits are kind of front-loaded for the individual so that you may see initial benefits and then those could conceivably peter out, especially after the tax break goes away in 8 years.
Yeah, sure. So, I think there's you're going to see something somewhat soon, and it does sunset at one point. But for now, you'll probably see a bigger return next year, or just less taken out of your paycheck. Everyone likes a little more money.
Right. Tommy, in other news from D.C., there was talk of a government shutdown. In fact, the fate of the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, was in limbo. So was the CHIP program, Children's Health Insurance Program,
yep.
Senator Hatch initially authored, other programs as well. A temporary fix is in place now, and Congress is officially in recess, right?
Yes. So this is we're quite used to this. Congress is good at one thing, and that's punting, which is what they did yesterday, just to pass a temporary bill to fund the government through January, essentially, to get some more money for CHIP through January, and then we'll be back to the same situation of facing a shutdown around January 19.
Okay, a stopgap to sort out after the recess ends. An interesting side note, Utah Senator Mike Lee was the lone Utahn from our delegation who voted against this continuing resolution to fund the government, right?
Yeah, he's not a fan of continuing the FISA program, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and he doesn't believe that we've had the real good discussion on it, that we shouldn't just be kicking the can down the road and keep funding it and approving it for temporary times. He thinks there needs to be a real big discussion on this, and he was not happy that Congress did reauthorize it for the next little while.
The FISA program. George Pyle, just before we head to a break, I want to mention something and get your thoughts. I mentioned uncertainty over DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which shields young immigrants from deportation. Governor Gary Herbert this week signed onto a letter urging Congress to save that program. He was one of a number of Republican and Democratic governors signing this letter. It was instituted by President Barack Obama. It has been rescinded by President Trump. Doing something to address the so-called dreamers, these young undocumented immigrants, has now been put off a little bit further, at least until January, as Tommy mentioned. Your thoughts on Governor Herbert taking a stand for DACA and on the delay in Congress on getting a deal on the program?
Governor Herbert in particular, and Utah Republicans in general, I think because of the Mormon history, are rather more sympathetic to migrants, immigrants, refugees than perhaps are your normal Trump voter. You had somebody basically become president of the United States based on anti-immigration. But not everybody, even in his own party, feels that way, especially for DACA. A lot of people have a lot of sympathy for people who are technically here illegally but came here as babes in arms or children and have no memory of the country they came from, speak English, act like every other American kid, as Republicans and Democrats have said. This is the only country they know. They are home. And the president, when he suspended the program, partly, I'm sure it was to suck up to his base, partly is because there is a decent legal argument that it did exceed the president's authority and that it ought to be by statute. And the president said, if Congress wants to do this, Congress should go ahead. I just think it's not something that should be done by executive fiat. And a lot of people in Congress said, sure, that's great, we'll do it. And it's one of those things that they haven't gotten around to. And I haven't followed it as closely as Tommy has, but it does seem like it's got an awful lot of support out there, bipartisan support, and you'd think they'd be able to get it done.
Tommy, momentum for DACA?
You know, it'll probably get done, but I mean, the momentum is there. It's just it's just the political will to get it actually to a vote. And at the moment, they're not too interested in making the actual vote happen.
Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington bureau chief. Does your job at least get a little bit calmer now with Congress in recess?
That is the hope. Trump is headed to Mar-a-Lago. The Congress is gone for a couple weeks. I'm hoping to get a little rest.
Okay. Speaking of rest, we're going to head to our first break. Tommy, thanks for joining us for this part of the show, and I know you got to go, but we appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we return, we're going to talk about the great, or maybe not so great, Salt Lake. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod, editorial page editor George Pyle, and Salt Lake Tribune movie critic Sean P. Means. This is our Friday morning news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us at 801-355-8255. Emma Penrod, environment reporter, you recently wrote a story about the Great Salt Lake, which has been shrinking. Scientists are looking into the causes of the shrinkage. To start with, though, can we hear how diminished, how much the lake has shrunk in the past decades?
Well, that depends a little bit on how you look at it. Mm-hmm. And when these particular scientists were looking at the decline of the Great Salt Lake, primarily what they were looking at was the water budget on the Great Salt Lake. So what they found was that human activity has reduced the amount of water flowing into the Great Salt Lake by about half, which one could then argue reduced the lake by about half in terms of area. And it has seen a decrease. I think the number that's been thrown around or that was thrown around in the study was about 11 feet. And that's a lot of area on the Great Salt Lake, which is a very shallow lake. So if you lose just a little bit of depth, you lose a lot of area and a lot of water on the lake.
Right.
But one of the issues you do have on the lake is this discussion of, you know, as the lake levels fluctuate, how much of that is natural and how much of that is caused by people? Because the lake does fluctuate naturally, and humans have diverted a lot of water away from the lake. And so what we're seeing is kind of both issues. And at any point saying, you know, the reason that this lake is at this level is because of X is a little difficult because there's so many issues playing against one another.
A number of variables. One thing we can say is that this is sort of a long-term decline, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's been happening for maybe more
160 years is about the span that this particular study covered. And that's kind of necessary to look at these longer-term trends because even within a year, the lake can fluctuate quite a bit as it, you know, loses evaporation over the summer and then, you know, accumulates water in the winter. These are kind of the natural cycles that the lake has. And these guys are trying to get beyond the natural cycles and say, okay, but really what kind of an impact have humans had on the lake? Because we've really taken quite a lot of water away from the lake and it's not getting water from any other source.
And the taking water out is, I mean, essentially the tributaries that feed the lake are being tapped for other uses is the idea, right?
Yes.
And that's increasing and expected to keep increasing as the population grows. And that is something that is worrying to the authors of this study. I mean, they look at it as a problem.
Yes, because the Great Salt Lake is, it's a what is called a terminal lake. So it's not like, you know, other lakes maybe where you might have a river that goes into the lake and then a river that comes out of the lake and eventually flows out to the ocean. In those cases, you're having, obviously, you have enough water there that water can leave the lake and there's still a lake. With the Great Salt Lake, water flows into the Great Salt Lake and it only leaves when it evaporates. And yet the Great Salt Lake hasn't, you know, flooded the entire valley because of this accumulation of water. And so there's a small enough amount of water going into the lake that it's roughly balanced out by the, you know, evaporation coming out of the lake. And that's the situation you have in these terminal lakes. You know, the Great Salt Lake's not unique in being a terminal lake.
But it's one of the reasons that it's as saline as it is as well, right?
The
evaporation is taking away water and leaving
and
salt.
And because, all the salt that flows into the lake in the water, there's a small amount of salt in a lot of water. So all the salt just kind of accumulates there in the lake rather than flowing to the ocean, which is also why the ocean is salty.
It's interesting. In this article, you get into what conserving water could mean for the lake. You say that your reporting points to that if you take shorter showers or if you don't flush your toilet as often, it might just mean that a water district maybe has more water to sell to other users, which in the end doesn't really sound like it's doing much for the lake or for water conservation in general.
Right. Water conservation is a really tricky issue, again, when you're working in a terminal basin like the Great Salt Lake. And you hear a lot of things thrown around in Utah about, well, water conservation doesn't help the lake or water conservation hurts the lake. And it's because there's this really complex interaction. When we, you know, take a shower in Utah, the water goes down the drain into the sewer and eventually out to a wastewater treatment plant where they take all of the, you know, bad stuff out of it or most of the bad stuff out of it.
Right.
And then they actually send it on to the Great Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. And so that's what is called a non-consumptive use of water, because that water goes back into the water system. And that's 71% of all the sewage on the Wasatch Front is eventually deposited into the Great Salt Lake.
After it's been treated
and
cleaned to a certain extent. A more nefarious use of water is consumptive water use, because it's not coming back. Tell us about that kind of water use.
Right. And so this is when you use water that actually, or use water in a way that actually removes it from the basin and from the cycle here more or less permanently. So if you water your lawn, for example, a lot of that water will evaporate off your lawn, or it will, you know, your grass will drink it up. And that water isn't going to go into the sewer system. And it isn't going to get to the Great Salt Lake. It's going to evaporate up into the atmosphere and go somewhere else,
generally east.
Yeah, exactly. East of here, Denver or there on. I don't know exactly where it would end up, but it doesn't end up in the Great Salt Lake.
And so for residential conservation efforts, xeriscaping your yard is a way to combat this. But, and I almost hate to say this because I don't want to dissuade anyone from saving water, but even if every resident of Utah xeriscaped, you write that it wouldn't do all that much in terms of lake levels, because that's not how the vast bulk of our water is used anyway.
Right. The, you know, figure that gets thrown around is something like 80% of the water that, you know, is used here in Utah is used for agricultural purposes. There's really a very small amount of water that is being used for municipal purposes. So, you know, the people who've looked at this have kind of concluded that, you know, if every single person on the Wasatch Front xeriscaped their lawn, that would maybe be great, but it probably wouldn't be enough to bring the lake back to where it is or where it theoretically should be. You know, there's this number thrown around, you might have heard, the 4,200 feet.
Yeah.
Of elevation, that's the hypothetical normal level for the lake.
Right.
There is some debate whether that's actually normal for the lake.
Right.
But right now, what's normal for the lake, you know, outside of natural variation, is actually about 5 feet below that. And so when scientists look at what you would need to do to bring those 5 feet back up to what, you know, it's theoretically supposed to be, they're saying, you know, it wouldn't be enough if everyone conserved water and everyone xeriscaped their yard, it'd be great, but it wouldn't get us there.
Everyone meaning residential users. A big culprit here is, a big user of water is agriculture, especially alfalfa, which is maybe Utah's biggest cash crop.
It is, yes, almost certainly the largest crop in Utah. So, and this is because of the fact that you can make a lot more money on alfalfa than you can make on other crops in given a variety of conditions here on the Wasatch Front. So I think there's sometimes an inclination I have seen to maybe among some people to want to malign farmers, but this is really they're trying to do what they can with the circumstances they have. And those circumstances have promoted growing alfalfa, much of which is actually shipped out of the state and sold elsewhere. And yeah. Alfalfa uses a lot of water compared to other crops.
And it's essentially being used for hay, right? I mean, you grow alfalfa and then you make hay for agriculture.
Right. That's what it is. It's hay to feed animals.
Okay. Okay. And you said most of that is exported. Does that mean, I mean, to a certain extent, that kind of means that we're exporting our water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, that's true.
Well, and it doesn't go against, but there's a comment on KCBW's Facebook page by John who says that the lakes are as good as gone with a drying climate and an expected 6 million population, 6 million person population by the year 2060. Does population growth play into this, Emma, in terms of how much water is being conserved? Obviously, the more people, the more water usage. But
right.
If the bulk of it is still agricultural use, how big of a part is that 6 million person growth?
Well, that is also a really tricky interplay here, because if you take a farm, you have a field of alfalfa, say, and there's population growth, so land values are going up. The more land values go up, the harder it is for that farmer to make money on his farm. And the easier it is for him to just sell his land to a developer to put a subdivision on it and for him to make money that way.
Right.
And when that happens, you actually see a reduction in the total use of water, because the farm will use more water per, acre than the subdivision will. And so as, more people move to the Wasatch Front, we will see some of these farms taken out of production, and that water then will not be used as heavily. Mm. However, as the population grows, people will continue to use water, and so the demand for water will increase in that way. Demand for municipal water will increase, which may, as some of these scientists point out, incentivize more development of water, which is not what these scientists want to see. If you want to see the amount of water going into the Great Salt Lake stay the same or increase, you don't want more water taken away by pipelines or dams or these kinds of things.
You write also that in other places, maybe other countries actually, schemes have been implemented, and probably other states as well, where farmers are paid not to use their water. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they retain their water right, but they're just paid to conserve their water. That's kind of complicated by Utah water law.
Yeah. So, for example, in Colorado, there are arrangements where you can, the farmer will receive some money to just let his, fields rest for a while, which tends to be good for the field and for the soil. And while he's not using that water, he then is paid by other interests that want to see that water used elsewhere for his water, allowing, again, the farmer to make money. We were talking about the circumstances that, force the farmers to do some of these things in some cases. That helps them get out of that. They can still make money without growing alfalfa.
And without selling the farm.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is another thing Utahns have stated. They don't want to see these farms paved. They don't want to see the farms sold and turned into subdivisions. And so if Utahns, these are all conflicting interests that Utahns will have to decide what they want done with. But so what the problem is in Utah water law, we have a kind of a use it or lose it principle. Mm-hmm. The idea that all water has to be put toward what's called a beneficial use. And the beneficial uses are generally defined in pretty specific ways, like growing something is seen as a beneficial use. Mm-hmm. And so what the argument is that we need to change the law to give more ability to maybe say, putting water in a lake is a beneficial use. It's not wasted water. But legally, it's kind of the way it works. And so people who've tried to buy water or, lease water or create some kind of an arrangement to leave the water in the lake, they're legally barred from doing so.
So some people I know that you spoke with advocate for calling conservation of water a beneficial use, essentially. I mean, when you put it out in the lake, or
right? Yeah. They want to give the make it so that there's a right to water essentially on the Great Salt Lake. That there's a certain amount of water that we say the Great Salt Lake and nature has a right to this water, and it's a beneficial use to have water in the lake, and therefore we can allow the water to go to the lake instead of requiring the water to be used.
Okay. Again, we want to hear your thoughts on this. Call us at 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. Emma, we've talked a lot about conservation here, but last week on this same show, you and I talked about the Lake Powell pipeline. Mm-hmm. I bring that up because the lake is fed by the Bear River. That is, I think, historically the lake's biggest tributary. Mm-hmm. There's a plan out there for a pipeline to divert a chunk of the Bear River. Obviously, doing that would have a big effect on the lake as well, which is probably an understatement. What's going on with the Lake Powell pipeline? With the Bear River pipeline.
Yeah, that was discussed by the scientists who did this study, and they did look at, you know, the impact that would have on the lake in terms of reducing it probably by several inches at least. And what was interesting was I talked to some of the people who originally proposed this project, and all of them were saying, look, this project is going to be extremely expensive. It's going to be costly in terms of environmental impact, and we're going to try to take a variety of other actions before we take that step. And one of those actions included, you know, trying to implement a lot more dramatic conservation features to try to get people to reduce their water use so that they could, you know, and try to avoid building this project. Mm. Even though, you know, some of those steps, like they want to install water meters on a lot of secondary water use in like the Weber area.
Mm. Secondary water use meaning?
Water that's used, it's untreated water that's used typically on lawns and gardens.
Okay.
And in much of Utah, as we discussed last week, that water is completely unmetered.
Right.
So anyone who's using it, whether they want to conserve it or not, they don't know how much they're using, nor does the state know how much they're using, nor does anyone else know how much they're using. And so one of the efforts is to put these very expensive, you know, meters, they can cost, you know, $1,000 a piece, on these systems so that, you know, because just metering it and having people be aware of how much they're using is shown to dramatically reduce water use. Mm.
George Pyle, I've had you here. We've been getting a lot of details from Emma and have yet to hear from you about this issue, which is the, you know, the drying up of the Great Salt Lake. How concerned are you about that? I mean, it's the namesake of the city and of the newspaper you write for, as a matter
right.
of fact.
Right. Oh, yeah. We're going to it's the Salt Lake. Start calling it the mediocre Salt Lake or the once great Salt Lake or the lake formerly known as Great or something like that. And as Emma says, a lot of this is cyclical. A lot of this depends on climate. We never totally understood why the lake goes up and down. We just know it does. So this can be sort of like when people argue about climate change, is like how much of this is really man-made and how much this just happens. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, you can't know. So what you ought to do is pretend like it's on us and we'll do everything we can. From our point of view, water needs to be more expensive. It ought to be, especially, you know, after you can set a level that's a normal household use, and then everything above that, you pay a lot more per gallon to use it. It ought to be paid for in the water bill, so you are price sensitive, and maybe you stop watering your lawn so much instead of so much of it being paid for through property taxes. Property taxes that churches and governments and universities do not pay, and so they are insulated from the cost of all that water that's running down my street after they water all the lawns up at the U.
Yeah.
So it ought to be bill-based and not property tax-based. And I think, really, I mean, they do the surveys, they do the Envision Utah, and they say, you want agriculture in Utah. Everybody says, oh, yes, please. I don't think they're thinking alfalfa. They're thinking farmers markets. They're thinking orchards. They're thinking peaches and strawberries and things like that. The alfalfa, and a lot of that is going to go away anyway because the land's going to be subdivided. Hmm. And some of it will probably go away if we start charging people what water really costs, and then the farmers are going to be even more likely to sell out and say, look, build houses here, I'm out.
Yeah.
I would hate to lose, you know, like the orchards and the dairies and things like that. That would be bad. But we don't need vast amounts of alfalfa farmers shipping our water to China.
Right. Emma, just we got to go to a break here in a second and move on to other topics. We haven't talked about, environmental concerns, bird life. For millions of birds use the lake as a stopover. Mm-hmm. And what would happen to them if they don't have that habitat? Some of them fly 5,000 miles from mm-hmm. Argentina. Also, human health concerns. There is a concern about dust storms. Can you quickly tell us about that, and then we'll head to a break?
Yeah, because as we've mentioned earlier, the Great Salt Lake is the end point for the vast majority of the wastewater that we produce on the Wasatch Front. And as a result of that, we've had decades and decades and decades of every undesirable waste product known to man being put in the lake. And as a result, there's a lot of toxins that have settled down into the settlement of the Great Salt Lake, including a lot of heavy metals and other concerning substances that if the lake were to dry up, those substances would then be mobilized when we have dust storms like we did this week,
yeah.
Potentially, and everyone would be potentially exposed to those things.
A concern. Okay, well, Emma Penrod, thank you very much for your reporting on this. You can find it at sltrib.com. We're going to head to a break, and when we come back, we're going to take a big turn and go to look at new movies with Tribune movie critic Sean P. Means. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more of our in-house podcasts, visit kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Emma Penrod, George Pyle, and Salt Lake Tribune movie critic Sean P. Means, who is joining us right now for the first time. Thanks for being here, George. And George, wow. Sean P. Means.
Yeah, we get that all
George,
the time.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks as well for talking about holiday or movies that are out this holiday mm-hmm. season. I read the Tribune a lot, and you have a lot of movie reviews out. You've been seeing a lot of movies.
Christmas week is usually very packed because they figure everybody's home and not in school, and they go see movies. And for families, it's great because it's 2 hours you can spend with your family and not talk.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So, you know, which for some families, that's a requirement.
Maybe avoid political conversations.
Exactly.
So just so I'm not wasting your talents and time, George.
No worries.
George, I keep saying George. I don't know what's going on here. I want to quickly jump into this because we don't have a lot of time left. And a question that I have is if somebody is listening right now and they were going to see just one movie between now and the end of the holidays.
Right.
And I know that as a film critic, you probably hate this question. What should they go see?
Well, presuming that they've already seen Star Wars 3 times.
Okay. Yeah.
Which, you know, I know people who have. The one that's opening this week that is probably the most worth it is The Greatest Showman. This is a very tuneful musical about the life of P.T. Barnum.
Right.
Hugh Jackman plays Barnum, and he's a song and dance guy. I mean, before he was Wolverine, he was Curly in Oklahoma,
right.
The revival. So he definitely puts all of his heart and soul into this. This is a passion project he's been shepherding for several years.
It looks kind of Moulin Rouge-y to me.
It is kind of Moulin Rouge-y. It is very definitely not a, you know, historically accurate portrayal of Barnum's life, but it does get into, you know, how he went from being a poor tailor's son to starting a museum of oddities and then deciding that, you know, that would be more fun if there were actually living people in there. And so he found Gerald Tom Thumb and the Bearded Lady and Dog Boy and all this sort of, you know, freak show aspect of it and turned it into a show for the masses. And became world famous because of it.
That opened this week, right?
That opened today. It has songs from the guys who wrote the songs for La La Land. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of local talent. Kiala Settle, who went to SUU and BYU, plays the Bearded Lady and is a breakout star-making role for her.
Wow.
Will Swenson, who's the scion of the Hale Center Theater family, plays Barnum's father. Mm-hmm. And Lauren Allred, who was on The Voice, who went to Weber State, does the singing voice of Jenny Lind.
Okay. Represent the Utah representation mm-hmm. in this movie. All right, well, I have to go. I mean, you mentioned having seen, or if you haven't seen The Last Jedi 3 times in a row yet,
right.
You got to see it. Are you a diehard Star Wars fan, and is this a worthwhile must-see?
I can claim that the first movie review I ever wrote for my 8th grade journalism class was Star Wars.
Ah, I love it.
So the original. And so, yes, I've grown up with these characters my entire life, and this one is a summing up in some ways. I mean, it's the middle of a trilogy, so there's still one more coming out in a couple of years, episode 9.
I haven't seen it yet, so no spoilers.
Yeah. No. Although the musical number is great. No.
Hugh Jackman's role.
It's a lot of fun, and if you are in that world, if you understand the Star Wars world, you definitely want to be on board for this one.
You'll like it even more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, without any prelude whatsoever, I'm going to jump to a movie that I'm excited about, mainly because I'm just a big fan of the lead, Gary Oldman,
right.
Who plays Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. You wrote that you liked this mainly because of Oldman, right?
Gary Oldman gives a great performance. He brought this makeup guy out of retirement, the guy that did Jim Carrey and The Grinch and did Benjamin Button, to get the face right for Winston Churchill, because, you know, Churchill was 5'6" and pretty, you know, burly. Gary Oldman's 5'9" and is skinny as a rail.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But he gets the voice, he gets the mannerisms, and he gets the liveliness of Churchill. I mean, we think of Churchill as very being gruff and growly, but as I got to interview Oldman, and he said that, you know, you look at the newsreels, and he's like very sprightly. He's always like marching ahead of everybody, and he like wants to get moving, wants to get going, and he captures that. Uh-huh. And in this movie, it's all set in about a month's period. When Churchill first becomes prime minister, and it's right before the retreat at Dunkirk,
right.
Third movie this year about Dunkirk, and it's some of the biggest speeches in Churchill's career were during that period. So
other good roles, other good actors in this movie.
Stephen Delane is in there. Ronald Pickup as Neville Chamberlain. Ben Mendelsohn playing King George VI, who is so good he will make you forget about Colin Firth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
just for a moment,
Emily.
Emily, producer Emily's giving a dirty look here. Just because we're low on time, a movie that you would probably recommend skipping, and I'm sad to see it because it looked like something promising to me. It's Downsizing.
Downsizing. Alexander Payne, who did Sideways and The Descendants and Election, usually great work. This one is a misfire. It tries to be social satire about overpopulation and consumerism, where in the near future, scientists figure out the way to solve overpopulation is to shrink everybody down to 5 inches tall. And so people sign up for this like they're signing up for a timeshare. And Matt Damon is this everyman, goes through this and realizes that, you know, life being small has got just as many problems as life in the large size world.
Maybe it would solve our water problems that Emma was
discussing. They talk that very thing, things like that, exactly. Yeah. But this one, it just falls apart in execution. And Matt Damon, he's way too bland. And you consider that, you know, how much time has been spent in the movies, you know, rescuing Matt Damon from peril, you know, in Interstellar, The Martian, Saving Private Ryan.
So much
more. This one is just way too boring.
Okay. Skip that one then. Also, the Tower Theater here in Salt Lake City is showing what you described as a really, really awful film, but it's drawing big crowds.
Yes.
I think anyone who's been paying attention to the film world knows the movie we're talking about and why it's drawing crowds. But the big reveal, Sean, what is this horrible movie?
It's called The Room. There's a 2003 cult classic now. It was made by this guy named Tommy Wiseau, who is possibly the most untalented human being ever to have a camera pointed at him. He self-financed this movie, which he wrote, directed, stars in, and it is so unredeemingly awful that it became one of those so bad it's entertaining things that people would watch ironically and laugh at the screen. And
right.
You know, they didn't throw hot dogs like Rocky Horror, but it came pretty close. So much so that it took on this weird life as a cult classic. There was one of the stars of the movie wrote a book about this process. The book was turned into a movie called The Disaster Artist, which is now in theaters with James Franco playing Tommy Wiseau and his brother Dave Franco playing Greg Sestero, the actor who was his friend at the time. And because of The Disaster Artist, there's new attention being paid to this movie. And I make the point in my Cricket column that I don't find this movie to be so bad it's entertaining. I just find it to be so bad it's bad.
Have you seen The Disaster Artist?
I've seen both. And Disaster Artist does give me some appreciation for what the other people in the cast had to deal with. But it also gives me appreciation that Tommy Wiseau himself is not a nice human being. And there's things he does in this movie, things that he did making The Room, that now in the Me Too generation would get, you know, end your career,
right.
And he's being celebrated for it, and I find that kind of repellent.
Hmm. Also, a weird character. We don't know where he made his money, how he financed this movie.
Right.
Bizarre, interesting story. We are so low on time here, and I think we might. So if we're missing anything, if we're going to see anything this week, we should go see The Greatest Showman.
Right.
Okay. About P.T. Barnum. Let's move to underplayed stories really quickly. We only have a minute and a half, but I'll stay with you, Sean P. Means. What's your pick for underplayed stories?
Well, we are coming up on the Sundance Film Festival next month, and this year, if there is a theme coming out of Sundance, it's going to be the Me Too Festival. Issues of what has happened to women in Hollywood and what should be happening with women in Hollywood are coming up. There are some major documentaries with people profiling people like Gloria Allred and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Joan Jett and Jane Fonda. Plus, we've already had one movie drop out of the festival. Morgan Spurlock's Super Size Me 2 dropped out after he self-confessed some past misdeeds.
Okay. The Me Too Festival. Emma Penrod, your pick for Underplayed Story.
So this is actually something we've mentioned in stories, but haven't actually done a story on independently, and that's the fact that it's been super dry this winter.
Yeah.
Less than half of normal precipitation, and that's causing a lot of issues, like the inversion that we saw and the dust storm that followed it. So.
Okay, dry winter, underplayed story. George Pyle, really quickly, your underplayed story.
Christmas Day, 2017, Utahn of the Year will be in the Salt Lake Tribune. I know who it is, and I'm not telling.
All right, secret. keep an eye out, Christmas Day. I'm going to go with amateur Utah astronomer Patrick Wiggins making two supernova discoveries this year out at Stansbury Park, seeing new dots of light appear in the sky from one night to the next twice this year. He's done it four times in total, and I think it's pretty amazing. Sean P. Means, Emma Penrod, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thus ends another edition of Behind the Headlines. Many thanks to KCPW operations guru Jesse Ellis, also to our partners in Utah Public Radio and Logan. That includes Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, and Alyssa Roberts. And to Emily Meekin, who produces the show. Podcasts are available at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us, and have a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, however you are celebrating. We will see you next week.